This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
There were certain things that Moshe found very difficult to understand about the design and the functioning of the Mishkan when he was told to build it. And one of the things that the Medrash records on the Osu Aron Atzei Shittim, Hayo Mistakel V'Roye, Moshe Rabbeinu considered and he had a look and saw Sheshloimo Oimed Uvoine Beis HaMikdosh. King Solomon was to set himself up and to build a Beis HaMikdosh, which was much, much bigger than the Mishkan. And nevertheless, even though he'd built this enormous structure, this magnificent building, the Omar Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he still says to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Ki ha'omnom yeshev elokim al oretz. Is it possible that God can dwell on earth? What does it mean to have a home for the Ribbono Shel Olam, to have a dwelling place for the Ribbono Shel Olam? Is it possible that the Ribbono Shel Olam can dwell on earth? How can that take place? Omar Moshe. So Moshe said to himself, Uma beis hamikdosh hu yoser v'yoser min ha-mishkan. If the Beis HaMikdash, which is so many times bigger than the Mishkan, Shlomo Omer Kein, Shlomo says, can Hashem dwell on the earth? Mishkan al achas kama v'kama. How is it feasible to think that the Ribbono Shel Olam could be contained in the Mishkan, which is a much, much smaller structure than even the Beis HaMikdash was? Lekach Omar Moshe Yoshev b'seser elyon. And that's when Moshe composed the Perek of Tehillim that we say so often, that he who dwells in hiding is Elyon, is the highest God. Omar Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Simon, Yoshev b'Seser hu Elyon al kol b'riyosof. He who is able to dwell in a secret place is above all of his creations. And then it goes and says, B'tzel shodai yislenan, ma b'tzel shadai, b'tzel kel, b'tzel rachum, b'tzel chanun en ksivkan. It doesn't say Hashem dwells or that one may dwell in the shadow of and uses all the other names of Hashem. Elo Betzel Shaddai, the name that is used is Shin Dalet Yud, that particular name of Hashem. Because that name, Shaddai, comes from the word Dai, which means enough. It's a limitation. Most of Hashem's names describe limitlessness. The name Shaddai, which is the same name that we write on the outside of the mezuzah, indicates the limitedness of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That the Ribbono Shel Olam, despite the fact that he is limitless, has the facility, he has the capability to limit himself. And that's what we're going to discuss this evening. It's not a long shir, but it's a rather deep shir, in understanding this ability of the Ribbono Shel Olam and the desire sometimes to limit himself. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo kashem sha'ata sovur kach ani sovur. I don't think the same way as you're thinking, Moshe. Elochof keresh betzofin, the chof bedorim, the ches bemayrov. 20 beams in the north, 20 in the south, 8 on the west, and that's sufficient. And not only that, eloshe eired veatzamtzem shechinosi besoich amo alamo. I will come down and I will contract my presence into a space occupied by one cubic amo. And amo is about a half a meter, I think, would be about what an amo is. So we're looking at a half a meter by a half a meter by a half a meter, which was the size of the Oren. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I will contract myself into that space. So your amazement at how can it be, even in this magnificent structure of the Beis HaMikdosh, Shlomo HaMelech says, is it possible that the Ribbono Shel Olam can fit himself into this structure? What chance is there of the Ribbono Shel Olam fitting himself into the structure of the Mishkan? Not only that, says Hashem, I'll fit into the Oren as well. One Amo by one Amo by one Amo, I'll fit into that too. You don't have to worry about me. And what we're going to discuss this evening is the relationship of the size of the container to the volume of the content. And notice that the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't say to Moshe, you're thinking wrong, Moshe. It's incorrect. He simply says, Loi kemoshe ato sovur, loi kashem she ato sovur kach ani sovur. I don't think the same way as you do. The way you're thinking is valid. It's okay. But it's not the way I think. Which altogether is an important ability to have. And it's an important middah to be able to have. One doesn't have to assume that every time somebody else comes to a different conclusion to the one you come, that they are wrong and that you are right. It's not always so. There are different ways of approaching a problem, there are different ways of viewing a problem, and it can be that within the frame of reference of that particular way of thinking, it's right. It's just not the same way of thinking. And so we see here that there are two systems of thinking that will lead in this matter to completely different conclusions. The one system of thinking, the physical system of thinking, Moshe's scientific system of thinking, leads to a conclusion that a limited container cannot contain limitless volume. That's something very simple and straightforward that any child knows. A container cannot contain a volume in excess of its capacity. But there is another way of thinking. There is another dimension to thought. And that is the limitlessness of the content. And to understand it, imagine that a human being could only see two dimensions. So he could see planes, but he couldn't see cubes, and he couldn't see cylinders. He could see circles, but not cylinders. And imagine you showed the person a cube of a cubic meter in size. Now, to him, that would look like a square. A cubic meter, it looked like a square meter of space. And imagine you said to him, now here is an enormous barrel of water. How much water can we pour into this container? The person will say, well, very, very little, because it's all going to spill off. It's all going to spill off. The amount of water that he can visualize, that square being able to contain, is a very small volume of water. The moment you introduce the third dimension, he all of a sudden realizes, no, now we can contain a lot more than that. By the addition of the third dimension, he is able to understand a different ratio between the container and the content. So imagine if there's a fourth dimension which we can't perceive, then it is possible that, the content can be even more in excess of what we can visualize a container able to hold. But Hashem says to Moshe, look, Hashem sha'atosov kachanisov, I see the world differently to the way you do. You're right. From your perspective, you're right. And Shlomo HaMelech was right. How could this enormous Beis HaMikdash contain God? And if the Beis HaMikdash couldn't contain God, how can a little Mishkan contain God? And if a little Mishkan can't contain God, how can a tiny little Oren, how can a tiny Ark contain God? That's the way you see it. But I don't think that way, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. The way I think, not only can the Beis HaMikdash contain me, but the Mishkan can contain me. Not only the Mishkan, even this little box, the Oren, one cubic Amo, I can contract myself into that as well. One cubic Amo can contain the limitlessness of the entire Shechino of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Something that we find very difficult to understand. This means that there is a dimension of limitlessness to the physical world. That it is, let us say, if it is possible for a physical unit, one amma by one amma by one amma, that's a half a meter cubed, to contain limitless content, then there is a measure of limitlessness in the physical world as well. And that's something we're not used to considering. We like to think the spiritual world is limited, is limitless. Hashem is limitless. Spirituality is limitless. The neshama is limitless. But once you get into the physical world, you're dealing with the measurable. And the measurable is limited to those measurements. There's no such thing as limitless objects, as a limitless physical world. That we don't have. And what we see this evening is that that's not so. That we grossly underestimate the limitlessness of the physical world in which we operate. That in the very physical, limited world in which we operate, there is a dimension that we fail to perceive. The dimension of limitlessness. And that opens all sorts of possibilities. There's a very important Ramban on this week's Sedra. In Perichofei Posuk Chavdalet, Zer Zohov Soviv, around the Shulchan, around the table for the Mishkan, you will put a golden sort of little trellis around it, a little like a little crown around it. Simon, Rashi says, Simon le keser malchus. That's an image of the crown of malchus, the crown of nobility. Shal shulchon shem usher ugdulahu. Because the shulchan represents wealth and greatness. Interesting, again, ties up to last week's shir and to the shir on Monday on Iyu, that wealth is something spiritual. We can misuse wealth just the same as we can misuse anything else. We can misuse our brains, and we can misuse our neshomas, and we can misuse the Torah. And anything can be misused and it can be abused. But inherently, as we discussed, the power of wealth, the ability to discharge indebtedness, is a spiritual concept, and it's represented in the Mishkan by the Shulchan. HaShulchan Shem Oysher Ugedula. The Shulchan represents wealth and material stature. It's represented there right in the midst of the Mishkan. It's something important. That doesn't mean Chas V'Sholem that one sacrifices spiritual things in order to attain wealth. That doesn't mean that one works on Shabbos in order to make money, or that one doesn't learn Torah in order to make a little bit more money. Of course not. But what it does mean is that wealth is something spiritual. That's not something to be denied. That's not something to be abused. That's not something to be cheapened. But the concept of wealth is a special bracha that the Ribbono Shel Olam gives, and it is spiritual in its essence. V'chein hadover, and so it is, says the Ramban, shezeh soid hashulchan, that that is the essence of the shulchan. Ki birkas Hashem me'eis heyos ha'olam lo'y tiborei yesh me'ayin. Because since the world was created, Hashem doesn't make anything from nothing. That's the main difference that took place at the moment of creation. Up until that time, to create matter, the Ribbono Shel Olam had to create matter out of nothing. From that time onwards, there is no creation from nothing. Aval olam kiminhagoy noheg. The world follows certain built-in programs. That's the difference. Up until that time, there was a creation from nothing. From that time on, for brocha, what does brocha mean? Brocha means multiplication, but we have a problem. The increasing of quantity is limited by built-in programs. Until the Ribbono Shel Olam created the world, he could create quantity. If he wanted quantity one day, he would create quantity. That's it. He wanted to create a universe one day, so he just created a universe. But that stopped at that point. Together with the creation of the universe, he built in programs and formulas. And from that time onwards, any bracha has to be within the framework of the programs that the Ribbono Shel Olam put into the world. And that's what it means, Vayara Elokim Eskol Asher Asor V'Hineh Tov Moed. Hashem was entirely satisfied with everything he created. That means he saw within the creation all that he would need to develop everything that would come thereafter. Aval kasher yihyeh sham shoresh dovar. But provided there is the root of something, Tochul olov brocha, the tosif boy. Then brocha, blessing, can be applied to that little root, and it can multiply. So there is built into the world the program for multiplication. There is built into the world the program for development. But there has to be a kernel of something to start with. Because from the time of creation, the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't create everything from nothing. It has to develop from something. And that's the story with Elisha when he said, "Tell me what you have in the house." And she found oil, and she filled all the kelim with oil. And with Eliyahu, there was a little bit of flour, and that went a long way. V'chein hashulchan v'lechem aponim boi tochul habrocho u'mimenu yovo hasoivu l'chol Yisrael. And so it was with the table in the Mishkan. Brocha started on that table. And from that it could go all over the world. But there had to be something to start with. And that's where it started. And that piece of Ramban is based on a Zohar, where the Zohar says, Shulchan ihu ikro. The shulchan is what's important, more important than the bread that it holds. Besiduro dilei, in the way it is arranged, lekablo birkon de la elo mzoine la alma. The shulchan collects brocha from above and gives food to the world. Umirazo da hai shulchan, and it is in fact from the secret meaning of this shulchan that nafik mezoyne la alma, that food goes out to the world. Tamad the Yisya'iv Beimila'ila, commensurate with the brocha that is applied to it from above. So the entire world, the food for the entire world, is sourced at the Shulchan from those two loaves of bread that sit on the Shulchan. That's the origin of the nutrition for the entire world. Once again, we see a strange relationship between the size of a container and its ability to contain enormous capacity. Two loaves of bread, how big were they? They might have been big loaves of bread, but how big were they? They fitted onto a relatively small table. The table was 2 amo in length and 1 amo in width. So 2 by 1, so it's about 1 meter by 1/2 meter. So the loaves weren't any bigger than that. You have 2 loaves. From that, enough food to feed the entire world. So we have 2 examples. An aron, 1 amo by 1 amo by 1 amo, can contain all the spirituality in the world. And a table, 2 amos by 1 amo, can contain all the food of the world. Doesn't seem real. And then we had that medrash last night, where Moshe was also amazed at something else. Where Hashem says you've got to build an altar. Moshe says to Hashem, you told me to build an altar. Atzei shittim, to be made of shittim wood. Uletzapoisei nechoshes, and to cover it with copper. Ve'omartoli eish tomi tukad al mizbeach. And you said to me, there's got to be a fire on that mizbeach. So what situation have we got? A block of wood covered with a thin sheet of copper, and a fire burning on the copper. Eino eish ma'averes oisa tzipui v'sorefes esayitz. How long is it going to take for the heat of the fire to penetrate through the copper, which, as we said last night, is an exceptionally good conductor? So there's no attempt to insulate it at all. Hashem chooses the best conductor of heat to be put around the block of wood, and then tells him to light a fire on it. Where is it? The Baruch Shem is not. Didn't he learn standard 6 science? It's not going to work. The heat is going to penetrate the copper. It'll start burning the wood. Hashem says to Moshe, Hamido Yisraelu hein etzlochem. Hashem, you're right. In accordance with standard 6 science, the conclusion you reached is correct. And that's how you ought to think. But that's not how it works with me. I operate with a different dimension. And somebody mentioned after last night, it's interesting that Moshe questions, and that Moshe is not criticized for questioning. If Hashem asks us to do something absurd, we have to at least stop and question. Not question in the sense of, I won't do it. Of course I'll do it. But just explain to me what you're asking me to do. It sounds so odd. We're meant to notice when something's odd. And the example I always give is the burning bush. And that I believe that if there was a burning bush outside this space HaMedrash right now, and it burnt and burnt and the leaves didn't get burnt at all, we would all walk right past it. We might, you know, call the fire brigade and ask them to put it out. But I don't believe any of us would notice that the leaves weren't getting burned up. And imagine what would have happened hadn't Moshe noticed that absurdity too. There wouldn't have been a Moshe, there wouldn't have been a Yisrael, there wouldn't have been a Torah, there wouldn't have been anything. Everything depended upon Moshe's ability to notice that that's absurd. And to question it, to go and seek. He had the curiosity, the need to go and question it. There's an outstanding educationalist. I've mentioned him before, and I said I would love to bring him out to this country. He's a world-class educationist. He's a Hasidic Yid with a long beard, and big hat, long coat. But he's acknowledged throughout the world as an expert in education, both of learning disabled children, or particularly of learning disabled children, and also of gifted children. And he often talks about the fact that we worry all the time, parents are worrying whether the children are learning enough at school, and is the standard of the school enough, and they pull them out from the school into that school, into the school, to that school. And he says, all a parent needs to worry about is that the curiosity of the child is enough. If the child has curiosity, he'll educate himself. You don't have to worry about anything else. He'll read, he'll research, he'll do whatever he needs to do if the curiosity is there. And if the curiosity isn't there, no school's going to teach him anything. And that is the main function of the parent in the early years of the child. Not to teach the child to learn to read a year earlier. You see parents sitting and forcing their children to read Aleph Beis or to read ABC. So what's the difference if they can read 6 months earlier or they can't read 6 months earlier? It's irrelevant. It makes no difference. What's important is the development of the curiosity of the child. And that's why I must say that I'm not altogether sure that I'm happy about all the frummy little stories that they now tell children at nursery schools and things like that. In the one hand, it's very nice, they're communicating values. But the people who are writing these stories aren't always as gifted in the development of a child's imagination and curiosity as some of the old fairy tale writers were. And I don't see any problem in reading to a child one of the old style fairy tales and then spending time to put the values in order, to discuss with the child what's right about it, what's wrong with it. You know, they banned all these all the terrible violence that there is now. Now Little Red Riding Hood is not the kind of thing, even in non-Jewish circles, is considered banned because it's violent. And you start banning all these things, the violence and this, you remove all imagination. There are no monsters and there are no dragons and there are no all the little things that actually arouse the child, make the child think and make the child feel and make the child imagine and use his imagination. True, what do we do about values? No? You have a session afterwards. Was it the right thing to do to gobble up Little Red Riding Hood? So you have a discussion. It's a wonderful opportunity to have a values discussion. When the only stories you feed the child on are strictly refined already. It's like feeding a person on highly refined food. If you feed the child only on those stories that are strictly refined, you don't even expose the child to the process of discernment, of deciding whether you want it or you don't, whether you agree with it or you don't agree with it, what's wrong with it, notice what's wrong with it. You don't even give the child the opportunity to develop the skill of seeing something and picking the holes in it, because everything is pre-censored. You only give the child censored material. I think that's very destructive, only to give the child censored material. Destructive because it doesn't teach discernment, and destructive because it denies the children of a wealth of imagination and curiosity that is stimulated by these old fairy tales and all sorts of things. Nothing wrong with them. They're fine, they're okay, provided they're taught by somebody who can put them in context and correct the values where the values need to be corrected. But it's not something to ban and to isolate. The parent's child and the parent's responsibility in the early stages of education is to teach the child imagination, to teach the child curiosity, to make the child want to find out more. And if imagination is not stimulated and curiosity is not stimulated, the child will not have a creative ability. Look, there's no way. There's no way a child who has not been stimulated with curiosity and imagination, that such a child will have a creative ability later on. It's not possible. So the child might be frum, fine, because you gave the child frum fairy tales. The child might not have nightmares at night because you censored all the scary ones. But the child will be an umidika, sort of one of these grey people that will go around his life, not particularly curious and not particularly stimulated in curiosity. One needs to understand there's nothing wrong with the colourfulness of that. And here we see Moshe Rabbeinu once again standing and saying, this is absurd. This can't be. You're asking me to build a mizbeach with a block of wood, copper, put a fire on top of it. This, something's wrong here. It isn't going to work. Notice that Rabbeinu Shlomo will work. In my world, these conflicting forces don't act negatively on each other. There'll be fire, there'll be wood, and the fire won't consume the wood. And we discussed last night why that is and how it is. But that's another example of where we're seeing that our method of reasoning is not reaching the conclusions that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to reach, and that the Ribbono Shel Olam does reach with his methods of conclusions. That our understanding of the relationships between things is not the same as the Ribbono Shel Olam's understanding. We see fire and we see wood. We see the one consumer. The one is a fuel for the other. The one will consume the other. We see a small container and an enormous amount of content. We conclude that the container can't contain the content. In our reasoning, we're right. But we're not right in the Ribbono Shel Olam's reasoning. Let's take it one step further. Maksiv Lamala, says the Medrash further on, Vayikhu li Trumot, starts off saying, take donations from people. Miyad, and what's the first thing? Ve'osu aronat seishitim. And make an ark. Maksiv Lamala, Vayikhu, says the Medrash, Ma ha-toyro kuduma l'chol, kach b'maise ha-mishkan hikdi misa'orun l'chol ha-kelim. Just as Torah preceded anything else in the creation, Hashem first created the Torah and then he created the world to fit into the Torah, so the Oron was created before all the other utensils of the Mishkan. Ma ha'ur kodem l'chol ma'aseh bereishis, just as light came before all other aspects of the creation, af b'mishkan ha'toyro shenikreis oyr, so also toyro, which is called light, kodmu ma'aseho l'chol ha'kelim. The making of the mishkan base of the orin came before the other kelim. Now this refers back to an interesting machlokes which we discussed a long time ago between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer ha'iro nivreis tchilo. Rabbi Yehuda says the world in the third parasha of Reishis Rabbo, that the light was created first. And Rabbi Nechemiah says that the world was Rabbi Nechemiah Omar ha'ilom nivro tchilo. Rabbi Nechemiah says the world was created first. Now this is a very interesting discussion, because when Rabbi Yehuda says light was created first, that was before anything else, and certainly before the sun. Even in the Chumash it says light was created on the first day and the sun was only created later on. So the light that they're talking about is not the light that emanated from a burning gas, whether it was the sun or anything else. If light preceded the Olam, that means light was created before matter. That means all matter, before the hydrogen atom it was created. That means energy was created before matter. And then you've got to read the opening of the Chumash as Bereshis Beroil Bero, you've got to read it. In the beginning of Hashem's creation of the world, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Oyer, Hashem said, let there be light. It was right in the beginning, before there was anything, the first thing that happened was, it's not that in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and then he said, let there be light. That's the way Rabbi Nechemiah translates it. The way Rabbi Yehuda translates it is, in the beginning when there was nothing, the very first thing Hashem said was, let there be light. Before there was any matter. So the light that Hashem created was not the light that resulted from the burning of any fuel. It was not any kind of combustion process at all. So what was it? It was energy. Where did that energy come from? Yesh me'ayin. It came from nowhere. Hashem made it. And then we discussed when we learned Parashas Bereishis that the word bora comes very seldom. Hashem creates only a few times. He creates in the very beginning. He creates when the animals are made. And he creates when man is made. Only three times, if I remember correctly, that the word bria is used. There's the creation at the very beginning, and that is the creation of energy, according to Rabbi Yehuda. He creates when the animals are created. That's a new thing. That's not an evolution. Animals didn't evolve. And then he creates again when man is created. Man also didn't evolve. Certainly not man in his completed fashion as we know him. But that means that matter was never created. Energy was created. That was on that first day. And where did matter come from? Obviously the Rabbeinu Shlom knew Einstein's theory, that you can create matter out of energy. You don't have to create from nothing. Once you have the energy, you can change the energy into matter. And that's in fact what happened. And it's quite amazing to see how science is now beginning slowly, hundreds of years, thousands of years after Rabbi Yehuda, to come to this understanding. That first there was energy, that's the whole Big Bang theory, which is now accepted very, very widely, and an understanding that whatever matter was created was as a result of this enormous amount of energy that was there to start with. And the Midrash relates the Oron to that Big Bang, that creation of light that preceded everything else. That's the Oron. How much energy does an atom contain? That should have already been the beginning of our understanding that our sense of relationships is cockeyed. That our belief that a small thing can only contain a small volume, Einstein already showed us that that's not so. How much energy can an atom contain? Enough energy to provide fuel for an entire city. Can we understand that? Can we relate to that? Until the time of Einstein, we were used to thinking, how much energy do you need for a large city? Don't think in terms of tons of coal. How many tons of coal, how many thousands, how many millions of tons of coal do you have to dig out of the ground and burn in order to develop enough energy for a city? And if somebody would have come and said, tons of coal? You need a less than a microscopic particle. It's called an atom. You can't even see it under a microscope. You can't even see it under an electron microscope. That's what you need, an atom. that can provide enough energy. We would have laughed at them, because we're using a certain understanding of the relationships between container and content. And we understand how much coal you need to burn in order to create a certain amount of energy, and we can't switch into a different way of thinking. That was the brilliance of Einstein, that he understood that this whole relationship of how much energy there is in matter has to be changed, because matter and energy are transferable. And so when Hashem made matter out of energy, according to Rabbi Yehuda, how much energy did he pack in to each atom of matter? Can you figure out? If you want to figure out how big the Big Bang was, take all the matter that there is in the world, in the universe, and divide it up into the number of atoms, and realize how much energy you get when you split one atom. That's all. Nagasaki, Hiroshima, how much energy you get when you split one atom. Multiply that by the number of atoms that there are in the entire universe. It means the world and all the planets and all the stars and all their planets and things around them. Take the whole lot together. And imagine splitting every one of those atoms. That's how much energy there was in that first Big Bang that created the matter. So for one little particle of matter, there's an enormous amount of energy that's packed in to that little particle of matter. And so our whole understanding of the relationships between energy and matter change. Our whole understanding of the relationship of how much energy can be contained in a little bit of matter, that changes. Everything gets turned upside down. Everything gets changed completely. And so it is when Moshe is trying to understand the Ribbono Shel'olam's ability, so to say, to pack himself into a small place. Just as light preceded the world, and a little bit of world, a little bit of matter could contain an enormous amount of energy, so it is, and so it is with the Torah. One little word of Torah contains so much. If you take one word of Torah and you start splitting it and you get the energy out of it, one sentence of the Torah, what there is in that. Take one sentence of the Torah and look at the volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes that have already been published on that one sentence. And how much more will still be published on one sentence of Torah. And realize that what has been published is only a small, small fraction of what there is there. And realize that in each sentence of what has been published, look how long we spend on a line of Gemara, how long we spend on a line of Tosfos, how much there is packed into that. So every line of Torah has pages and pages of Gemara. And every line of Gemara has pages and pages of Meforshim. And every line of the Meforshim has pages and pages of more Meforshim. The relationship between container and content is just something beyond us. That one little sentence in the Torah can contain so much in it. It says the Medrash that we should know from Standard 6 Science, that that's possible. That matter can contain limitless amounts of energy. One word of Torah can contain limitless amounts of spiritual energy. One word of physical matter can contain limitless amounts of physical energy. And one little space in the Beis HaMikdash can contain limitless amounts of godliness itself, of the Shekhinah itself. How does that work? What is it all about? There's a third medrash that we'll learn this evening. The last medrash in the medrash Rabbah on the parsha, "Vasisu es akroshim lemishkan." Omer Rabbi Ovin, "Moshal lemelech shehoyoloi ikunin noy." This can be compared to a king who had a very beautiful ikunin. The word ikunin can mean one of two things: either it can mean a little statue, or it's like an icon, or it can mean the form of his own face. He had a very beautiful face, he had a very dramatic face. Omar ben Beso, he said to one of the people in his palace, "Aseli kemoiso, make me a copy of it." Now, it's paint a painting, whether it's of my face or of this beautiful statue. Omale adoni hamelech eich yochel ani lasis kemoiso. It's not possible. How can I do that? How can I represent in paint and canvas the beauty of your face? Everything that it has, the dynamicism of the face, the expression of the face, how can I do it? So he answers, Omale ato besimim anecho v'ani bichvoidi. And I haven't seen a satisfactory interpretation of this medrash. And I think this is what it means. You are, I've asked you to do it. I know you're not a creator. You're not God. I haven't asked you to make another face. I asked you to paint a painting. Your tools for that are your paints, your colors. Use that. Don't use anything more than that. I'm not asking for anything more than that. You use your paint. V'ani bichvedi, and I'll apply to it my honor, my glory. And the two together will have the right effect. And in this medrash we have the essence of the understanding of what a work of art is. And through that we'll understand a lot of what many other things are, including the Mishkan. What is a work of art? You go and you look at a painting, and it's a painting of a field. Beautiful field, with trees, with flowers, beautiful sunlight, shade, there's contrast, wild flowers spotted all over the field, birds in the sky, and you look at the painting and it uplifts you. How big is the field that the painting portrays? Might be a kilometer square. How big is the painting? Might be half a meter square, it might be less than that. How is that possible? How is it possible that a bit of color on a canvas, a bit of chemical on a canvas of a small size, can create in me a feeling of upliftment similar to the feeling I gain when I'm actually standing in that field? How is that possible? That's the same question Moshe is asking. Moshe is putting his finger on an element of the human experience which he didn't grasp yet, and which through his building of the Mishkan he understood. And that is that it is possible for the human being to reach heights, to reach levels of experience that normally can be achieved only by being exposed to something very big and dramatic. It is possible for the human being to reach that level by being exposed to something much smaller and contained, provided the art of imagery is used. What is poetry? Read a poem, a few words, and those few words can arouse feelings in you as if you've experienced something momentous, something very dramatic. How? Because the painter has been able to create an image. That's the power of imagery. Imagery is something very small that contains an awful lot. That's what poetry is. Poetry is a small number of words that is full of content that contains an enormous amount. And if you're able to pack a lot of feeling into a small space, it becomes very, very powerful and can be used with enormous effect. And so when the king says to the artist, I don't expect you to make a replica of my face. Do an impressionist face. It doesn't have to be the same as mine. It doesn't matter. Ani bichvedi, I will use my glory. I will add to that. But by adding my glory to the work you've produced, the sum total of the effect will be the same. That there will be an understanding of it. It will be able to communicate something far in excess of the chemicals sitting on that canvas. Something far in excess of the size of what that really is. There was a salesman of mine who was trying to sell a particular piece of jewelry. And he went into the customer and he quoted the price. So the customer put the jewelry on this scale and he said, look, if I work out how much gold there is and the price of gold is X, and how much diamond there is and the price of diamonds is this, and rubies and sapphires, I come to the following figure, which is much less than the price that you're quoting me. No, thank you. And the salesman came back to me very depressed. Didn't know what to do, didn't know how to answer him. So I said, go back to him next time you're in the area. You don't worry about selling the item, but just explain to him. If he took the Mona Lisa and he scraped off the paint and he put it onto a scale, and he took the canvas and he put that onto a scale, and he worked out the total cost of all the paints that Leonardo da Vinci used and the cost of the canvas, would he reach anywhere near the hundreds of millions of dollars for which that painting is insured? Sometimes one has to be able to look at the content of a thing and see that it far exceeds the constituent parts. That one is able to create beauty out of putting things together. And that's what gives it its value, not the constituent parts. What gives it its value is its beauty. And that the beauty can far exceed its constituent parts. That's what a work of art is. That's what a piece of poetry is. That's what an image is. To take something small and contained and to be able to pack into that feelings and emotions and beauty that far exceed it. And so says the Ribbono Shel Olam to Moshe, that really is what we're talking about. You need to understand that when you're talking about the relationship between spiritual and physical, there is no limit to how much spiritual the physical can contain. When a physical object is containing another physical object, one is limited, the volume of the container will limit the volume of the content. You cannot take matter and put it into matter where the content exceeds the volume of the container. It's not possible. But if you're talking about energy and matter, you can. And if you're talking about spirituality and matter, there is no limit to how much spirituality there can be in one little molecule of matter. We're accustomed to thinking and to saying to ourselves, even in material things, there's a little bit of ruchnias. What we're saying is, oh no. In material things, there's an enormous amount of ruchnias beyond anything you can imagine in every little molecule of physical things. And that's why we have failed to understand the greatness of the human being. Because we've always looked at the human being as nothing but, like that particular customer looked at the item of jewelry. Now just take his biological, the sum total of his biological constituents, and put it all together, and he's a sophisticated animal, that's all, with a brain that's a little bit more sophisticated than the brain of an animal. Can't be much more than that. So he can be a very clever animal. But he's still an animal that has a brain. Not so at all. The human being has the capacity to think, to feel, to create, to experience, to reach heights far beyond anything we're capable of imagining. There is no limit. There is only a limit to the physical things we can do. That is limited. But there is no limit to the spiritual things that we can do. There is no limit to the energy we've got. There's a limit to the physical things, but there's not even a limit to the energy we've got. You've got these many examples of people, weak people sometimes, elderly people who in a situation of crisis are able to perform acts of enormous energy. Where they can lift a motor car off somebody who's got his leg under the cot under a wheel or something. You get a single person who comes all of a sudden and can lift it. There is no limit, even to the energy we've got. We don't know how much energy we've got. When we get tired, it's because we're bored, not because we're tired. When we get tired, it's because we're uncreative. When we get tired, it's because we're not functioning spiritually. It's got nothing to do with energy levels. And you can take glucose and you can go to the gym and you can do what you want. It's not going to make a big difference. The increment will be small. The magnificent differences, the exponential differences, take place when you start functioning spiritually, when the creative element is beginning to be active. Then there is no limit to how much energy the human being has got, how little sleep he needs, how much he can achieve, how far he can think, and how much he can do physically with his own hands. And spiritually, certainly limitless. There is absolutely no limit to what we're capable of achieving. We limit ourselves by not realizing what there is in every little molecule of matter. Never mind God. We like to think of God is limitless, God is limitless, and we think that's religious thinking. That's not Jewish religious thinking. Jewish religious thinking is that matter is also limitless. That in every little bit of matter there is limitless spirituality. And so Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, the Beis HaMikdosh is like that, like a work of art. It's small, it's compact. But you know what it contains? It contains all of me, says Hashem. And I'm not even the whole Mishkan. Just a little Oren already contains all of me. You don't have to worry. I can be mitzamtzem myself. I can contract myself into that kind of size. And the image you're seeing here is the image of the functioning of relationships that understand that principle. Again, that Ramban so beautifully puts it. That before the creation, matter was created from nothing. After the creation, matter is created from, as long as there's something there, it can continue. One little molecule, that's all you need. But from one little molecule, anything can be created. And we discussed in the Eiyuv Shir that once Adam had sinned, and Satan, that satanic force, the force of degeneration and deterioration, is built into the world. That now became programmed, but it wasn't programmed before. Up until that time, material things did not deteriorate. It was only after the sin of Adam that the material things started deteriorating. The Beis HaMikdash is a reversion to matter obeying the pre-Adam laws. Obeying the laws of physics that existed before the time of Adam HaRishon. And no psychologist knows those laws, and no physicist knows those laws, and no chemist knows those laws. They all relate to the world according to the laws of physics and chemistry and psychology and medicine that apply after the sin of Adam. But it's necessary to be able to see how the world used to operate before that time. How you could have a fire burning that didn't consume the wood. Not because the fire was weak and cool, but because the wood was powerful and potent and would not be burnt. That's why it didn't deteriorate. Because it didn't have deterioration programmed into it. It wasn't capable of deteriorating. It was necessary to be able to see all that in the Beis HaMikdash. To watch relationships. To see a small container being able to contain enormous content. To be able to see things relate, opposites relating to one another without destroying one another. That was the picture of the Beis HaMikdash that set the standard by which the Jewish people were meant to live and towards which they were meant to strive.